Welcome, everyone, to the November Policy Advisory Council. I'm Egon Turplin, the vice chair, standing in for Dolly Sandoval, who is unfortunately ill today. Hopefully, those that are missing are also not ill, but it seems a lot that's going around. We have a good, exciting meeting day, but let's just, because we're a few minutes late, just to get started, want to do approval of the minutes. Any edits or modifications, or does someone want to make a motion to approve the minutes?
Seconded.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Passes unanimously. Next item is public comment for items not on the agenda. Is anyone in public interested in speaking on something that's not on the agenda? I have no cards either, but seeing no public comment, item three is closed. Next item is subcommittee reports. I understand that the Equity and Access Subcommittee did not meet, so there's no subcommittee reports there. So with that, why don't we move to item five, Transit Performance Initiative, hearing about the incentive program with Kenneth Fullen.
Thanks, Egon. I'm Kenneth Fullen with MTC staff, and I am here to give an update on the Transit Performance Initiative, which was an initiative that came out of the Transit Sustainability Project that was passed by the Commission in May of 2012. And to refresh your memory on that, I wanted to just quickly read from the minutes of your meeting from March 2012 when we discussed the entire Transit Sustainability Project. And what you all adopted was a motion saying to support the staff recommendation with the caveat that it is important to ensure an appropriate enforcement policy and provide incentives for the operators to grow ridership and continue important lifeline services. So we are back today to sort of discuss one element of your motion there, which is the incentive program. So the TPI program, Transit Performance Initiative, has two elements to it. Today we're focused on the incentive program, but the other side of it is the investment program. In October, the Commission made a substantial commitment to both of these programs. On the investment side, a commitment of $82 million over 4 years, and on the incentive side, a commitment of $60 million over 4 years. So it's obviously a priority of the Commission, and we're here today to kind of discuss the mechanics of the incentive program. So again, the goal of the incentive program would be to use this $60 million to reward transit agencies that achieve ridership increases and productivity improvements. The funding, as I noted, was approved by the Commission in October, and there are a couple specific pieces of direction that I wanted to bring to your attention. The first one is that when the Commission adopted the sustainability project, they said, as we develop the staff proposal for the incentive program, there should be one option or scenario that holds small operators harmless. So we'll get into that later. And then the second one that I believe occurred in September was that an eligible project would be the youth pass or pilot pass programs. That would be an eligible project for this fund source. So what we've done, and I'll go through, is develop some scenarios that we can discuss. So one element of the October adoption was a transition year for the incentive program. And this would be the fiscal year 12-13 funding, and the Commission did take action on this. And what they did was they linked this first year, the first $15 million, to the ridership, the overall ridership of the agencies. And that small box on the bottom of the screen there essentially gives you a breakout of the funding for the first $15 million. So we'll be seeking input for the remaining $45 million, but this was part of the October Commission action here. And again, the transit operators can use the funds to support the pilot youth or low-income pass programs. So in October, staff developed proposals that essentially had two scenarios on how you would distribute this funding source. Scenario A up there breaks it out by three elements: 25% based on year-over-year ridership increase, 25% based on passengers per hour increase, that's the productivity piece of it, and finally 50% based on annual ridership. Scenario B is essentially the same as Scenario A for the large operators. However, the small operators would receive a fixed amount that's based on a prior formula, what was called the flexible set-aside formula. So of the $15 million, that hold harmless amount, the fixed amount for the small operators would be in the neighborhood of $2 million. At that meeting in October, the committee directed staff to come up with an additional additional alternative, and that's the one-third, one-third, one-third. And then finally, staff added I guess this would be the fourth scenario A version, and that was at 15-15-70. And I'll show some examples of that in a second. Also, staff was asked to come back with some improved transparency on how we sort of set out the information. Response since that commission direction, one thing that we've done is reviewed the data and the formulas to make sure we have that accurate. Secondly, because there was some data inconsistencies, we're trying to stick to one data source, which is the federal government's national transit database, and make sure that we stick to that and that we ask the operators for that data and that data only. And that should improve the consistency of the reporting. Finally, and this is or the third bullet there, this is quite important. We are considering an option that's not precisely year over year, but takes the prior three-year rolling average. And what that does is that essentially removes any spikes or peaks and valleys in the distribution of the funds that might be due to a one-time event with one operator or economic conditions that might be outside of the operator's controls. And then again, we've added some charts for transparency. So where that leaves us now is essentially with these three scenarios for distributing the $15 million each year, based on ridership increase, passengers per hour, and annual ridership. The annual ridership line, the third line on that chart there, that in some ways you can say that controls for kind of the size of the system. Obviously, the higher that is, the more it benefits the larger systems. The lower that is an opportunity for the smaller operators to participate more in the formula. And again, scenario B is the hold harmless option that provides a set amount for the small operators. And the next three charts are an illustration of how each of those three metrics would play out. So if we stick with the original staff proposal to illustrate this point here, this would be the passenger trip increase, the year-over-year increase in passenger trips. And if we used a three-year rolling average from 2008 to 2010, this is how that would have played out. So, again, this is weighted towards larger operators, but the big winners here, AC Transit, Muni, BART, Caltrain, and BTA. The second indicator or metric is the passenger trips per hour. Now this one is a metric where large or small operators would be able to benefit basically at the same or with the same they have an equal opportunity in this because it's a productivity-based metric. It's not based on raw ridership information. So as you can see, some of the primary beneficiaries of this in this three-year period are smaller operators. And finally, the third element or the third metric is just the annual passengers, and that essentially just tracks the largest agency on a passenger basis down to the smaller agencies. So those are the three metrics that are on the table now as part of the staff proposal and what the commission directed us to come back with. So on to what we're here for today to get some consideration and input from you all is, I guess, first of all, are these metrics, do you have any thoughts on the metrics that we're using? Ridership increase, productivity increase, and base ridership. Secondly, should the weighting of the metrics favor future performance, which is the ridership and productivity increase, or the existing ridership, which essentially is set based on that final chart there? And then the final bullet up there is, should the small operators be held harmless, or should they compete in their own pool? So let's say we were to set aside of the $15 million annually, again, the fixed amount that was part of the staff hold harmless proposal was $2 million. If they were to get that amount, that the small operators were to get $2 million, should they just get that funding distributed based on existing formulas, or should there also be a competition for them using kind of their different service and land use characteristics? So you kind of have a situation of should the small operators be placed with the large operators as part of one kind of global competition in the region, or should a certain set-aside amount be set aside for the small operators, and if so, should they be competing, or should that just go to them based on an existing formula? So the next steps after getting input from you all today would be to continue working with both the large and small operators. We've had several meetings with those groups, and then hopefully return to the commission. Right now we're targeting we were going to initially go in December, but now we're targeting January to allow for input from this group here, as well as more conversations with the operators. And again, call for projects for the transition year would occur right now, but for these three competitive years, the call for projects would be next year. So I think that's a quick run through, Egon, and I'd give it back to you to start the conversation.
Great. Thank you, Kenneth. I think that was very clear and good overview, but I think maybe we can start with some clarifying questions just to make sure people understand the data and the kind of measures that you're proposing before we get into a
sure.
response to your particular thing. So maybe you could address questions first, start with Frank and then Richard, and then Carlos. Thank you.
I have a general question, which based on this data, what are we doing concurrently to bring about coordination, streamline, consolidation, to bring about efficiency and cost savings to taxpayers? What are we doing on that track? That's my first question.
Okay, one of the elements, or one of the three metrics, and I'll bring it up right now, is the annual passenger trips per hour. And that obviously is under consideration as one of the three metrics. It could be weighted differently according to what the input would be. But this specifically addresses efficiency. It's passenger trips per hour. So the more passengers you have on each bus, the fuller the bus is, the more you are rewarded in this situation. That's why some of these smaller operators up here, like let's take the third one, for example, Vacaville, they are, you could consider them a kind of lean and mean machine. They don't have many hours of service out there on the street, but the buses that they do have on the out, on the street are usually full. So in this case, the operators that win in this category are the most efficient operators. So that is one example of what we are attempting to do through this competition to bring about efficiency. The other categories, the annual passenger trips increase. The more passengers you get on your system, the more fare revenue you're going to get, and that should also essentially build up your revenue at least. And finally, the third category, the passenger trips, is just a sort of normalizing indicator to make sure that there's some consideration of size of system to be part of this competition.
I'm going to follow up. One particular area where savings could be realized immediately is economists have said if they pool their resources and they negotiate and they use their buying power to buy whatever equipment and vehicles they need, current evidence in the field tells us they will save money. There is no doubt about it. And what is preventing us from, at least that should be the simplest thing to do without sacrificing egos and territorial warfare. What is stopping us from
doing? Egon, maybe I could...
If you wanted to jump in and talk
quickly,
about...
Yeah. That particular idea was a separate from what is being proposed today in this presentation. If you recall, in the Transit Sustainability Project, the joint procurement opportunities were of interest to the Commission as well. And under the capital priorities process that we conduct every couple of years with the operators, we will be looking specifically for opportunities for joint procurement of major items. Right now, there's already fuel and parts and a lot of other jointly procured items, but we really want to look for the bigger ticket ideas.
I just want to know that that's also being considered. Thank you.
So perhaps we can get a presentation on that as it goes forward, as we've been getting on other aspects. Yeah, Rich.
Okay. Yeah, just clarifying, since I'm in the Solano area and where Soul Trans is, obviously there's, I talked to their staff, and since they're the new one where they're just combining the Vallejo and Benicia one, they're not yet going to have the NTD information for Soul Trans as yet. I think they told me that it'll be like a 12 to 18 months or so before they have it, then they can give it to the Fed. So I think that information there is based on the old, you know, when it was Vallejo Transit and Benicia Breeze. So at least in the Soul Trans case, that's not, you know, it's not current information. So I think that, you know, the transition year and then moving forward, I think, you know, it's going to be a little tricky for them on that. And then my comment on the, you know, you're saying whether it should be a global thing. I think with the small operators, I think that probably it should be the small operators are in one group. That's what I would favor as opposed to the global thing. I think the small operators would, not be competing too much with the bigger operators for, you know, the pie and stuff, and it would help them better.
Carlos?
I had a clarifying question on the productivity and efficiency metric that you're using, and the annual passenger trips per hour. I guess when I look at it, I know one of the trends you said is that it seems to bubble up the smaller agencies, but it also seems to bring up the heavy rail systems, and so I'm curious, is that because this way of taking the metrics is maybe looking at what systems have more capacity? Because I'm thinking like an SF Muni, they may be running at capacity. So in terms of being able to increase, I don't know. I'm trying to understand that better, because they, in fact, maybe what would be helpful for us is not only to see a per hour increase, but just see what the overall annual per hour amounts are. Just like you have the one for the passenger trips on slide 9. You know, it would that be pretty much the same curve as you see in slide 9, which shows Muni way out in front, then BART AC Transit. Would it be similar to that?
Yeah, you bring up a good point. If you think of it in the simplest terms, if you have a 10-car BART train or a 6-car Caltrain train, you tend to have higher passenger trips per hour because you have one vehicle that's moving more people. So that's a good point. I'm not quite sure I understood the second part. If you're trying, you were saying a comparison.
Yeah, looking at the next slide shows an annual passenger trips just total, and I was wondering if you had similarly done an annual passenger trips per hour, would it be a similar curve as that one?
Annual passenger trips per hour.
I think, Carlos, you're asking.
I think it should track this chart.
Right.
I don't know. That's why I'm asking if
I can get back to you on that.
One of them is increase, you know, an annual increase. The other one is just overall, mm-hmm. like who has the most annual passenger trips per hour. I don't know if it would mimic that next slide, or would it be more like that slide that you're showing there?
Yeah, it should. If you took this final annual passenger trips and divided by the hours of service, it would equal this chart. Yeah.
Is that clarified, Carlos?
I'd like to.
I mean, it might be a little different because that shows an increase, but I think that it doesn't track the same. So I have Kathleen, Benna, Rich, anyone else? Okay.
On slide 3, for the initial proposal for the first year of funding, how was the roughly $2 million, the $1.7 for other operators, how was that determined? What does that roughly break down to be based on the scenario A kind of allocation?
For the transition year, the funding is distributed completely based on ridership. So the 1.7 for other operators would essentially track, it would track this slide. You know, the big operators, that's why Muni had 7 million, because they were almost half of the 15 million, and you get down to some of the smaller operators. So they are, relatively small amounts of the 15 million for the small operators, because it's based completely on ridership. And the top seven agencies have 95% of the ridership.
And then under the different scenarios, A1 and through A3, what is the pot that ends up going to small operators if we're not doing the $2 million set aside?
It would be a competitive process, so it would vary based on the way they scored on these three charts. But essentially, we did do some running some numbers, and based on the past 3 years, they did better than the $2 million that they would be guaranteed as part of the flexible set-aside. But certainly that's no indicator that going forward that they would do better. You know, that would be a risk that they, you know, would be taking moving forward.
That's all.
Benna.
I just wanted to understand the process a little bit better. So I understand that this year was already been taken care of, but for the next 2 years you would use this formula. And would the money go directly to the transit agencies to figure out how they want to spend it? Because you mentioned the call for projects as well.
Yeah. So the transition year is the first of 4 years. That was $15 million. So there is $45 million remaining, and it would be three separate competitions. So there would be essentially three annual calls for projects based on how they did in the competition that year. They would be assigned an amount. And then at that point, the eligibility, the fund source is federal funding, so that has some requirements on how you use that. And then on top of that, the program requirements for our Transit Performance Initiative program are that they improve ridership, mm-hmm. or they improve efficiency. So we are looking for projects that improve ridership and improve efficiency. One other type of project that was added in by the commission was that these funds would be an eligible source for the pilot youth pass or pilot pass program. So that's a third way that these funds could be used. So the first two categories are quite broad. If you think that a type of project will help you in a competition in a future year, that would be a good use of the fund. So it should be somewhat self-serving.
Well, I'm thinking in Santa Clara County, they're talking about a light rail efficiency project, and that's a capital-heavy project that will take a long time to do and also to see the results potentially. It might not be a we can complete this in 1 year kind of project. And so it sounds like for something like that, it may not be a good fit for this pot of funds, because you wouldn't see the results right away, so you would, in a sense, be penalized then year two or three for that.
Yeah, I think in theory that's right, but I also think that we would give a fair amount of discretion to the agencies because they have to compete the next year. And if, you know, they're obviously managing all sorts of priorities and they understand they need to do good in the, do well in the competition the following year, there would be some leniency on what type of projects. But we would issue guidelines on what would be eligible and not eligible. But essentially, efficiency and more passengers is what we're looking for.
Okay, let's go on next. Rich? Microphone.
Thank you. I'm looking at this and trying to discern, obviously, like everyone else, is what the best solution. And I think it really depends on what we want to accomplish, which one of these we choose. If we want to reward those, you know, and stop me any time if I'm making assumptions that are correct, okay, please. If we want to reward those agencies that are hauling the largest amount of people, then we would go for the higher figure on annual. I think it falls somewhere in between. The passenger per hour certainly would, I think, limit what the long haul, like rapid bus, train, maybe even BART. I'm not sure because BART makes fairly rapid stops. So that would work against us. It may be some formula actually other than some of the things you have here. It might be something like 40, 15, and the rest knocked off of the 70%. So I don't know where the sweet spot is here, and it's really depending on what we want to do. And I don't know that we've made that decision. Maybe we have. I mean, if we want to reward those people that are hauling the neck, the most amount of people, then you would go to annual ridership, I think, very heavily. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's a very fair assessment. We are trying to make that balance on how do we balance ridership, how do we balance productivity, how do we balance increases in ridership. You know, what one thing that was suggested by some of the operators when we met with them is that after 1 year, after we see the first results of what we've created through this program, that we should do a assessment of the program. And I think that was a valuable suggestion because we're going to try our best to get the right balance, but it may need to be tweaked for future years. I think that out of the sustainability project, we are focused on increasing ridership and increasing productivity. And those are sort of the two themes, and to try to get the balance right is what we're here for.
Just a follow-up. When we count these numbers, do we count them based on existing bus lines, for instance, with a bus company, or in other words, just line per line, or is it system-wide? Because if a system like AC or Samtrans cuts off a route, that for efficiency, that may affect their numbers in this if it's not counted properly.
Yeah, it would. The numbers would be total system numbers by the operators. And you're right. If you could cut something, and it's going to help you in one of the three subcategories, and it's going to hurt you in the other.
Exactly.
And that's the nature of trying to balance this stuff.
Okay, I'm just trying to get this all in perspective. Thank you.
Well, maybe we'll try. Yeah, we have three more people that want to kind of ask clarifying questions, and then maybe we can have more of a robust discussion about some of the things that you raised. Rich, if you could turn off your.
Sure.
You're like Wilbert's next, then Elizabeth, then Carlos.
Yeah, I was concerned that the annual passenger trips per hour increase. For the large operators, they're mandated to operate so many hours at times, you know, by the board or by the city, so that they're at a disadvantage sometimes. They have to run the schedule into the wee hours sometimes. So if we're looking at ridership increase, now how do you balance that against operators that only operate during peak times or, let's say,
That's part of this balance. I think that Rich was talking about. That
so the first year, would you take a look at and see whether there's any deficiency in the formula or any adjustment that needs to be made?
Yeah, that I think is a decent way to look at it. Is after 1 year, we can come back and see what the results were. I mean, there are factors that are beyond agency control in some cases. You know, if there's a upswing in the economy, that should mean that you get more riders on the system. If there's gas price considerations, would move the ridership, and especially when we're talking about ridership, you know, big swings will help big operators more than the small operators. So there's a lot to consider here and try to balance.
Elizabeth.
Okay, so here's another balance question. With regard to smaller providers, are there any allowances made in your process for external factors? One example I'm thinking of is in Petaluma, where I live. We have three major transportation corridors that for about a year will be very, very heavily affected by construction and by infrastructure improvements. Huge deal, because we are a very, very small community, and I would imagine that ridership is going to be low for the period during which that's taking place. I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, and then Carlos.
Well, maybe just
final
clarify that. Sorry, I think that's why the three-year rolling average is a key piece. And I, the more we talk to folks, I think that's going to be probably a fundamental part of the program.
Okay, so now continuing our fair and balanced discussion here, I wanted to talk about those three scenarios, and I was just wondering, without going more into balance right now, because I think we'll talk about it in a second, have the transportation providers chimed in on these different scenarios? I'm assuming that this same conversation has been brought up to their group too.
Yes, we have met with some initial discussions with the operators, and I think it's fair to say that at the moment the larger operators feel that the ridership is very important. The smaller operators have concerns that productivity should be important, as well as I think they are leaning towards having a certain amount walled off for them. And the conversation then becomes, as I tried to articulate in the beginning, should that be a mini competition for the small operators, or is that just goes by formula? So that's sort of some of the initial feedback we got, and they, both of those groups thought it'd be a good idea to kind of reconvene after the first year and see what the results look like. We plan to go back to them with some more to get more input and also tell them what you all have to say.
All right, well, I have two clarifying questions, and then I want to turn over to really answering your specific questions. My first one is, if you could explain a little bit for the group, what is this source of money, this $15 million a year? Is it money the operators are currently getting now, and under what ratio? So essentially, is it new money or existing money? And if it's existing money, what's the current distribution? So maybe just answer that, and I have a second unrelated.
I think the easiest way to answer is it is new money. Our projections of what is coming in the next federal authorization, we will be getting the same amount of the federal transit funds. The source of this money is the STP CMAQ fund sources, which are federal sources that are eligible for multi-modes, not just transit. So that is coming out of that, the One Bay Area grant pot of funding. So it is new money for transit.
And I think maybe that's important for all of us as we're listening, thinking about our questions, that this is an opportunity to shape and create an incentive, as this is framed, for better performance. Second question I have, just to clarify, in the passenger trips per hour increase, That's the only metric you're proposing under the category of efficiency. And I think some questions have been raised about the implications of choosing that metric. Why did you not consider an efficiency metric that had some that was both mode neutral and had some version of kind of cost control? And so just simply, when I look at this, this definitely seems to favor rail and, you know, ferry operators and those types of things. Pack a lot of people onto a trip that takes a certain amount of time, but they're not running a lot of service all the time, and that the rubber tire, the buses, are the ones that don't do as well here, versus something that's mode neutral, like cost per seat mile, which has cost and seat miles in there, but it's mode neutral. I think you would compete evenly across them. So just curious, Anne or Kenneth, why other metrics of efficiency weren't included?
I think that we did consider multiple metrics for this one. I think the passenger trips per hour is one of the most standard ones that's used kind of throughout the country. Other metric that is passenger trips per mile would even benefit the rail and the long haul carriers even more. So I think after discussing with the operators and wanting to use something standard that we can make comparisons to nationally, this is where we landed. Certainly the one you mentioned, that's something maybe they use in airlines and they have success with it there. I think some of it is we went with a metric that was familiar to everybody and hopefully easily to understand, but also getting to the root of effectiveness.
Why don't we turn over to responding to your questions? I don't know if you want to put up those questions there and sort of get a list. And we have probably 20 minutes we could spend more on this. So and it would be good if we could summarize our comments at the end to share with the commission. So. Sure, Frank.
I have been taking part for a while, and lately I have realized that ridership has actually increased, but the number of trains remain the same, and it's quite uncomfortable. And these people, how do you evaluate folks or entities that actually increase ridership without providing the necessary comfort or effectiveness that customers require or need?
Yeah, I mean, the example of BART, I think the great story there is that they are experiencing record ridership. I think in some time points of the day they have capacity problems. You know, they are working on something called the BART Metro thing that is essentially going to build back up the core of the system and address some of these capacity issues and some of the customer comfort issues. So that, I don't know if that's specifically being addressed by our competition here, but I know that BART is addressing those issues with the BART Metro program.
Great. So let's get, so Tina, you want to be first in line for the questions. Anyone else kind of come in? Yep.
So I have another clarifying question. I'm sorry. So some of the transit agencies have, you know, buses that are running in towns that it's pretty hard to get people to take the bus, like, let's say, Danville, for instance. And you said that this funding is meant to be for alternative modes as well. So is there anything in the metrics that would allow somebody like an agency like that to be able to be rewarded for other programs such as ride-sharing programs, real-time ride-sharing programs, things like that, that could be funded?
I may have misspoke. This funding, the $15 million annually, is for transit projects that are eligible with the fund source and that go towards effectiveness and increasing ridership. I mean, having said that, an agency could use funds to do shuttle buses, that kind of optimize how they operate in small communities like that, because obviously in a lot of communities a big long bus isn't the solution. So I think there is some room for creativity with agencies in that are not in the immediate urban core areas.
Okay, but it would have to be a transit service such as a bus or a rail or a ferry. Okay.
I think that's fair, yeah.
Okay, Jim, and then Benna, then Carlos. And then
I'm on? Oh. All right, good. In talking about effectiveness and efficiency, would it be possible to work out a formula where you could use both ridership by the hour, which I do like, but also take into consideration the neutral mode aspect as well?
Well, I would say that the passenger trips per hour, again, is a it's not perfect to balance all the modes, but it does passengers per hour. As you can see by who is benefiting there, you know, up top you have a ferry operator as the highest ranking, and then you have a regional train, Caltrain, and then you have a bus-only Vacaville. So it is possible to do well in this category across the modes. I don't think this metric is so biasing against any mode.
Yeah, because they both, it sounds like both of them have their advantages. So the gentleman to my left talked about balancing, and I think that's just important to keep in mind.
Great, thank you, Jim. Benna?
So I will go to your questions, and your first one is about our ridership increase productivity and base ridership, the correct metrics. I think the answer is yes on the first two, ridership and productivity. On the base ridership, I'm not so sure. I feel like there should be a metric around overall ridership, because I think it's important to spend the resources in the way that benefits the most people. Overall, from a regional perspective. So I'm not sure that base ridership captures that, does it?
The base ridership is simply
hard numbers.
All of the transit riders. So it does in the sense that you know, Muni is going to get 45% of that category, you know, down to the tiny operators that get a small amount. So it simply mirrors the ridership of the region.
Okay. Then great. I think that's great. That's really important. On your second question about future or existing, I think since this is supposed to be an incentive program, we should really favor future performance. That's what we're trying to drive at. And then in terms of your last question about small operators, I think it does make sense to have them compete with each other in another category. But it also makes sense to allocate funding to that category according to how many riders there are for that group as a whole. So I don't want to see, it's not a 50-50 split, for example.
Great, thank you, Benna. Carlos, and then Alan.
So I'm going to echo a lot of what Benna said. I feel that, but I wanted to add some comments on the... to me, it seems that any one of these scenarios, we're talking. It's going to definitely have per hour as well as ridership increase in and they're going to be equally, because you know, one's 25%, 25, one's 33, one's 15. So they're going to be equally weighted, and I think from my standpoint, I think it should be all three should be equally weighted. So the 33, I think we should be rewarding those systems that are trying to do something in the future, like what Benna said, trying to improve their efficiency and their ability to serve as many people as possible. I want to throw a caveat there, something that Frank brought in that I think is really important, is that, and I don't know how you could do this, it might come out in the regs, but you don't want them to start packing in people onto the same amount of rolling stock, and so that they're getting more per hour, increase, but they're the comfort level, and eventually it'll boomerang on them. So I think that I don't know how you would be able to steer them and say, if you reach a certain threshold, then you need to start, you know, putting in more stock and rolling stock so that you can actually provide a level of service that's comfortable for people. And then the other thing I was going to say on the I'm going to lose my train of thought. Let me just go to the small operators. I do agree that they should be held harmless, and I could see that these systems might the metrics would definitely skew against them. So what I do like, though, is since once again we're rewarding agencies that are really trying to do something different in the future to try and improve the service, then once again I think that they should have some form of being measured against one another in maybe amongst their group. And the third thing I was going to mention, which is kind of outside of the scenarios, but it's to the point that was being made both by Aegon and Jim, I believe, that especially when you deal with this passenger trips per hour, I respectfully disagree. I do feel that there's a skewing towards heavy rail and these once an hour type systems, or like the ferry, because I didn't even know what WETA was. Now I realize it's the water system. So it's definitely there's a skewing towards that. And so we really need to look at maybe even breaking that out in by mode type thing, where maybe the heavy rail and ferry are considered in one category, and then the others who are more rubber tire and maybe light rail together or whatever in a separate category, just because I feel that it is skewed towards, and just my feeling is it's skewed towards those heavy rails and those, you know, couple times an hour type service.
Alan, and then.
Well, I have to agree with three different metrics on an even balance between the three different metrics. I think it weights the highest population area maybe a little too much to where they're getting almost a tax. I think that competition by its nature is supposed to come up with ideas that other people can use. And I think those ideas might come from anywhere in the system. And that's why I think we should even consider giving the small operators a bigger piece of the pie, because many times that's where the most creativity is going to come from, to show the other systems maybe new ideas that they could use. If it was permanent funding, it's one thing. But this is a program, and it's a bonus. And bonuses should give us something aside from instant benefits. And the instant benefits can be given like loading up trains or loading up buses and then taken away, or reducing routes and loading and then taken away. I think that credit needs to be given for the creativity of the idea and the output of the idea through the rest of the systems to really make use of this money and make the money more of an investment than just getting ridership up for a period of time. So I think the small systems need to be looked at with a little more, because the big systems, just naturally being big systems, are going to get a big chunk of the pie. And it's not going to hurt them that much giving a little more to the small systems. So those are my comments. I hope I've answered some of the questions.
Great. I think Rich is next, then Kathleen.
There have been so many thoughtful and good comments throughout this period that it's really hard to distill all of them, quite frankly. But I'm going to split the blanket here a little bit. And I think I have to agree with Benna that ridership increases and productivity increases are very important. But for another reason, I agree with Alan also. You can't ignore the overall annual ridership, because the need for maintenance and other issues to keep that system to the point where we continue to carry those large number of riders. So if there's a way that we can design a system that of reimbursement where we can give an understanding that ridership increase and productivity increase is very important, but we also spread the money so that the big users or the big haulers of people have the money they need to keep their systems whole. That would be my take on it.
All right, Kathleen and Alan, if you could turn off your light. Sorry.
I had kind of a question. Well, there have been a lot of thoughtful comments, sorry, so I need to stay on my train of thought. But that is looking at the actual passenger trips. So the big seven, just kind of summing the percentages you've got here, Muni through Golden Gate would carry 96.1% of the region's trips. So to me, looking at who's carrying the bulk of the population, who's carrying, the vast majority of our workers daily, I think that needs to be rewarded and acknowledged. So I generally tend towards a higher allocation towards the 70%, but that seems too high. I'm sorry, towards A3, but that still seems too high and doesn't support the generation of new ideas in the smaller carriers. Was there any exploration of a potential 25-15-60 split? I mean, that might move the needle such a small amount that...
Well, I don't know if we looked at that exact amount. Let me go back to the screen where we have... If you focus on the annual ridership line, I think a lot of you have picked up on this. The higher the annual ridership is, the more it guarantees for the larger systems, because it essentially just says, based on who you are, because you're big, you get that amount. And we certainly have had conversations about what Alan has said about the need to give the small operators enough to kind of get their creativity flowing, because they, quite frankly, are the ones who operate service sometimes at half the cost of the larger operators. So that, there's a lot of important points. But again, you can't forget what you just said. 95% of the riders are on those large systems. So, I think landing somewhere for the large operators between the 50 and 70%, I think we're perhaps in the right ballpark. It's still giving the small operators some sort of a bump up. And I think I've heard from a lot of you, and Egan, I'm sure you're going to try to clarify this later, but it may be important to wall off a certain amount for the small operators and try to get them to focus on that amount. There's some moving parts to that, because if you wall off some for the small operators, you might really be having separate conversations about how the competition would be for the small and the large.
Which would be my next question, which would be what competition and what sort of criteria are we looking at setting up for that $2 million subset to the small operators? Would it still be on these three metrics?
I think we've sent it back to the small operators. I think there seems to be, between the large and the small, they are in somewhat agreement, and I believe I'm hearing from this group that it's a good idea to have two separate competitions. So I think that the first challenge is, of the 15 million, how much will the small operators get? They're probably going to want more than the $2 million set aside, and the large operators are going to maybe want less than the $2 million set aside. So that's it sounds like all groups are saying that's a good idea to separate those two. We have to decide how much money is separated, and then I think that you're right, the small operators would need to, based on, I thought we had it in here somewhere, should the small operators be held harmless or measured against one another given the different service and land use characteristics? So they might very well want to have different metrics, not the three that we had up there, or at least different weights to those metrics.
Great. Linda next, and then Wilbur, I think you, and then I'm going to jump in.
Okay, well, I was going to say that I think that the small operators should have something different. But one thing that you pointed out is that small operators really have a better fare box return per passenger. Their costs aren't quite the same. And, that's maybe something we should look at, and that would be a way to give them more money.
Is that a question for Kenneth on whether or not they have better fare box recovery? Or
yeah, the fare box recovery in reality is you know, BART is sky high at maybe 70%, and then Caltrain is next in 40s or 50s something, and then everyone else is hovering around the 25 and below. And I don't think on strictly fare box, the small operators, you know, they're about the same roughly as the others. They do certainly have a smaller cost per hour of delivering the service.
Wilbur.
Yeah, I have a question on the, you know, bus priority lanes, in other words, for transit first cities. Now, are they considered an efficiency addition?
That would certainly be eligible if someone came up with a project like
Thank
that,
you.
I would think.
All right, I'm going to jump here with a couple comments and then go to Tina. And I just maybe as a starting point, I think that it's, I mean, this is a big move, kind of what's happening. I don't know if it's, hopefully we're all kind of aware of that, that this is really MTC trying to condition money that, frankly, a lot of transit operators were simply expecting. And so this is a big deal, and as our motion from earlier this year, we really want to support staff in doing this. Kind of in response to your questions and maybe an attempt at a summary, because we should probably try to put together a motion at some point of our thoughts for the commission, the notion of really trying to think about the future and have this be incentive, a lot of people have raised that. There's been some disagreement clearly in terms of what's the absolute right percentage, and I don't know if we could come up with one for you here, but it seems like people here really want to support that, and also the notion that the smaller operators should have a different pot and should be competing against each other, maybe under different criteria. A point I wanted to raise, though, or two points I wanted to raise, one is that I think this could benefit from being a little bit simpler. I think you've simplified it very well, and it's very clear. But a notion that I had talked about earlier this year is just a simple bounty. Just come up with a figure, whether it's cents or a dollar, for every new rider, and you just pay it out to operators, mode neutral. You add a rider, you get a buck or 50 cents, whatever the right amount is. And I know you have a limited pot of money, and so if you open it up an incentive like that, what if they do a great job, but that's one where you're not dealing with percentage increase. So if someone goes from 500 to 1,000, they're doubling, whereas if Muni goes up a tiny, you know, goes up by 500, it's very small on a percentage level. So I wanted to put that back out there as another idea of not just doing increase as a percent, but just an absolute number and dealing and coming up with some amount that you get for every new rider you get. Because ultimately, this is just taxpayer money to try to subsidize transit or partially subsidize transit trips across the entire region. And I think there's a level of simplicity and clarity with something like that. Is sort of, that's kind of my comment. I don't know if others agree on that particular one. On the other side, the piece we haven't talked about at all is what they're going to use the money for and how you guys are going to evaluate what they come and present. And I would say I'm sure people here would be interested in that and kind of what criteria you would use. I want to add the comment, and Kenneth, I think you know this, I've said this to you before on the phone, is that the pilot pass program notion as something that the commission allowed clearly doesn't meet the objective spirit of the transit sustainability project. And that I would encourage staff, both in with that and with all the other things coming forward, that if people want to spend money from this incentive program, they should demonstrate how it meets the goals of the Transit Sustainability Project. And one thing you could do in these presentations is just start with those three goals. The financial goal meant increased fare box recovery. And I can't remember the details of all the other ones, but you guys had very clear and simple goals of the Transit Sustainability Project and put that back on the operators and say, if you want this incentive pay, not only do we distribute it based on this new formula, but you got to show us that the project you're going to do is going to meet these goals. So sort of two little things out there that I wanted to put forward, and maybe we'll keep going. Tina, you had a comment, and Rich. Okay, well, maybe if you turn off your light. And then maybe we should try to come together and see if there's sort of some common language around a motion that we might want to put forward. Tina.
Well, I can't wait to hear his response to what you just brought up, so I'll be quick. But I wanted to sort of clarify with you, Egon, is I hear you saying that you're suggesting maybe the idea of breaking it down, you know, number 50 cents per increased rider. But doesn't that mean that you would have to estimate, in order to spend the funds, you would have to estimate how many riders you're going to increase over the whole region and be able to be pretty accurate with that? Because then what happens to the money that doesn't get used?
Yeah, I think what Egan is suggesting in some ways is more the language that we use, because I would agree that there is some value in the simplicity of saying a bounty per passenger, but that essentially, if you took a set amount of money and distributed it that way, it would look like this. If you had unlimited money, you could pay out a dollar for each trip. But if you had a set amount of money, it would be distributed this way. But I think what we could take from that is that we should consider simplifying the language we use in saying in no other terms that this is, you know, you get another passenger, you're in the running for this money. It gets complicated when you have a set amount of money, because then you do have to break it by percentage. But I think we could do some thinking on that.
And then if we looked at the idea of having a separate competition for, say, ferry service and rail service, I mean, how many competitors would BART have, or how many ferry services are there? So it would really be no competition. Is that?
Yeah, I would say that our at the staff proposal right now, we would try to, in the spirit of simplicity, would be large and small operators. But to break it down by all modes, that gets very complicated, because you go from light rail to heavy rail to bus to cable car to ferry, and I'm probably missing others as well. So I think that right now, focusing at least this initial year on just large versus small might be a decent way to break it down.
Okay, so I just wanted to, I wanted to clarify that. And then, so I want to support the other comments that I strongly favor the idea of splitting up the small and having it be competitive for the small agencies. And I also favor the idea of having it be based on future performance, and also considering a tie-in with the sustainability project goals, if possible.
Great. Thank you. And I'll encourage anyone, as you're doing this, to try to you summarize some points really well to put together if someone's interested in a motion. Rich.
Well, I've listened pretty intently, and I tell you, I've heard a lot of great stuff. And I think we're going to put a motion together. I would prefer, personally, not to get into a Christmas tree effect where we try to encompass everybody's ideas we've heard today, because we've fallen into that trap before. What I would like to do is put together a motion, and let me just throw out three parameters that people can work on, that where we bifurcate the large and the small operators, and recommend that we base it on increased ridership and productivity increases. And to sort of give the staff a broad brush idea of what we're looking at, because I hear that pretty much floating around about, like you just said, splitting them up. I'm much in favor of that. So let's try to put something together. It doesn't have to be that. I'm not wedded to that. But something very simple like that.
Okay. Kathleen, you have a...
In regards to the past discussion, sorry to go back, because it does sound like we're heading towards a motion. Thank you, Rich. But in terms of the supporting a pilot pass programs, does that require any exception under STP CMAQ? Or is that something that has traditionally been an eligible use?
No, it would require the agencies to take the funding and use it for something else, and use local funding or another solution. But generally speaking, a PASS program is not eligible use of STP CMAQ funding.
Kathleen, are you suggesting adding that to something we want to others?
Yes. I don't have the proper wording for it, but just in terms of... I wouldn't advance that as a priority under this program if it's not something that is typically funded under those programs. I mean, it's absolutely worthwhile. I represent low-income
populations, but I would just put it, I think it's something that deserves its own discussion or its own commitment, separate.
Yeah. Egon, one thing that seems clear right now for your motion is a separate competition for large versus small. Another thing that folks are talking, or I hear two other things that you're talking about then. So that number one, it seems like there's some clarity on that. The second one is on which of the metrics should be used. And then the third one is on eligible projects. So it sounds like the first one is nailed down. Everyone agrees separate competition and for large and small, and the small should also be a competition. The second one, I don't know if you want to attack that one second, and then the third one as well.
Well, what I was going to maybe propose is just to treat it really simply. If there's sort of broad consensus, and we can make a couple kind of multiple motions instead of a Christmas tree, and just sort of take those one at a time. So maybe chair's prerogative, kind of to move.
I was going to
move on the first one to move that the Policy Advisory Council recommends that you separate out the large and the small operators and create a separate competition for both the large and the small operators for the incentive for the transit second, performance second, incentive program. any discussion on the? Okay. Any discussion on the item? Well, let's call the question. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the motion carries. Let's maybe address now the second question, which is on the relative weighting of the different performance measures and possibly whether or not those are the right performance measures, which we talked a little bit about. And it seems to me, just from what I've heard, the ridership increase, absolute increase measure, is one that that people seem to have support, that should certainly be one of the measures. Rich?
I'll just throw it out for conversation. Based on what I said very early on, I think that ridership should be a little higher, and I would propose 35, 15, and 50. Out of ignorance. Yes.
One thought is whether or not we want to have a specific number versus one that's sort of more broad direction. I heard a couple of people maybe even suggest that the annual ridership is one that maybe not consider that as highly. I mean, sort of that in and of itself is not an incentive pay. It's just a formula distribution.
I would agree. I think it's basically they're just getting the money.
I agree. It seems like double dipping almost to give the annual ridership and the ridership increase because it's favoring the same people.
Well, not necessarily.
No? Is that not right?
The problem with not tipping your hat to ridership is what I said before, is they have much higher maintenance costs.
Right. I think you do have to reward the systems that are carrying the most people. At the end of the day, we need to make sure that we prioritize our funding to go towards that. So I think it's a balance. You do need to have all three of those categories in it. And I don't think we should spend a lot of time figuring out the exact number, which is general comments about which categories are really important.
Carlos and Will, and then Jim, quickly on this, and maybe
if we're not going to spend a lot of time on the numbers, I was just going to point out that I do agree. I do think that the first and the third, you're capturing pretty much the same transit operators in those two categories. So any one of these scenarios, unless we go with a different one, like what's been proposed, that changes the percentages. I think the low range, you're getting 66% of the money going towards the same agencies, and the high range is, 85%. So that's kind of the area the range that these operators are going to get. And so just something to think about.
Will, and then Jim.
Yeah, I have a concern now for productivity improvements. One of the things is the reason I asked whether or not bus priority lanes are going to be counted on it. What happens is it doesn't tend to increase the ridership, but it increases the comfort level and the, let's say, the efficiency of the route. Now, what happens if you just want a ridership, if you have more equipment, then yes, you could put more in the corridor. But if you establish a corridor that's dedicated just to the transit rider, then we need to recognize the innovation that they're doing to improve the ridership on it.
Yeah, if you speed up a corridor, though, you should become more productive because you may have to not use as many buses, so that drops your hours down, your passengers stay the same. I would just, on one comment on, you all are correct that ridership increase and annual ridership, there is a higher correlation with those two. However, there could be a scenario where the top category ridership increase, if SF Muni, BART, and AC Transit have no increase and a small agency has an increase, that small agency would take the share of that category. So although, you know, if everybody has increases, the percentage for big agencies is more likely to be win more of that top category, it is slightly different than just saying it's exact same as annual ridership.
All right, Jim, and then I have a question. Hopefully we can try to get, we're in the home stretch now. Yeah, Jim.
Okay, good. We're in the home stretch. I'll be brief. I like the idea of balancing here between all the methods, and I don't know that we want to become too concerned about the percentages. I think 35, 15, and 50 is a little skewed. I would probably go more with something like 30, 30, 40. As you can tell, you know, I like to be as even as I can, but I think that's fair. So I'll just put that out for consideration.
All right, great. Well, I think we've had a number of kind of divergent comments here. I mean, one thought that it occurs to me is we could also make a recommendation that there's some modifications to the metrics that are proposed, because some of the implications of your comments suggest to me that the metrics aren't quite right. For example, the passenger trips increase is noted in a percentage as instead of a number. So if you created that chart in terms of total number of riders added over a three-year period, it would look different than it would in terms of a percentage increase. And meaning if it were distributed on there's X amount of dollars available for this performance metric, it would be distributed on a per-rider basis within a set amount of money. And you would just cut a check evenly divided by the number of people. So I'm just suggesting there's a different way. I don't know, Ken, if you want to respond to that. But that's a different way of taking that concept, and then the numbers would flow a little bit differently.
The methodology that you are suggesting is a little different. What we have done is when we say a three-year rolling average, we're taking a snapshot of these 2 years, you know, year one versus year two, then year two versus year three, and three versus four, and then averaging that. But if we did it what you were suggesting, that would just be comparing the very first year to the very last year. And we are also interested, at least the way the proposal is written, that we reward the year-over-year increases.
So, yeah, Tina, if someone wants to try to pull this together, because I see some divergent opinion, and it would be nice to, we can summarize it, but we may not be on the same page exactly.
So I don't know how other people feel. I've heard this a little bit, but I want to make sure, I would want to see, make sure that this is rewarding productivity. And there's, from what I understand, two of them don't. Like the ridership increase and the annual ridership don't reward productivity. Is that right? It's only the per hour?
In simple terms, that's correct, because it's only measuring the riders. The passengers per hour is kind of assessing how much you're investing in the hours of service. So that's the productivity.
Okay, so is anyone interested in trying to put this together? It seems to me we could have a motion that says the advisory council has support for all three concepts, that there's slight more interest in the in an incentive that's forward-looking and is based on productivity as being a kind of the more important notion, and it's fair to say that would be interested in seeing other metrics maybe proposed in addition to the ones that are, or instead of the ones here. All right, we'll cut that one out. But then,
we'll really get into it
there. Right. Well, this is a very. I mean, these are detailed issues that obviously millions flow one way or the other based on how it gets worded.
Egon, maybe the second bullet up there. I think that's kind of what you're saying. It says, should the weighting of the metrics favor future performance, ridership, and productivity increase, or existing ridership? Perhaps you could say yes to that question without giving percentages.
Egon, if I can, that's actually what I'd suggested a while ago as one of the, and I would put that forward that we've already passed the one on bifurcating the system, and that the staff focus on increased ridership and productivity metrics in order to come to the proper conclusion of amounts of money.
If that's a motion, I'll second it.
Yeah.
Second, any discussion? Any discussion on the motion? Okay, all those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, that motion carries. Now, the absolute last issue was whether or not we wanted to make a statement about the use of the funds, and something to the effect, without getting too specific, that when operators come to MTC to request the use of the funds, that they should demonstrate how the projects that they will use meet the goals of the Transit Sustainability Project, and that MTC staff will evaluate. They won't just cut a check, but they'll evaluate the proposals based on their adherence to those goals.
If that's a motion, I'll second it.
Motion. Any discussion on the motion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? That motion carries. Okay, so I think, thank you, Kenneth. Thank you all. This is a, transit metrics are a fun and imperfect science, but
thank you.
We look forward to seeing you, and congratulations on getting it this far. We're excited about it. Let's have Rebecca Long come up, and we will get through the legislative piece.
Good afternoon, everybody. Well, that was a long discussion. I'm glad I was here. I learned a lot about this project that I wasn't as familiar with myself, so it was useful. I'm going to walk through the draft legislative program with you that you should have in your packet. So just as a reminder, I came to talk with you guys last month, share with you some preliminary thoughts about what we were going to put into our ledge program, but we didn't actually have it drafted at that point, so now we're coming back. We just brought this to our legislation committee last Friday and did get some input on it that's not reflected here because this is the version that they saw. So I'll just walk through it, maybe take some questions at the end, and we'll go from there. So the first item is cap and trade. I'd say, this isn't entirely hierarchical as far as priority, but the fact that this is number one, I think certainly in my mind, drafting this document, that is probably one of our biggest priorities for next year. Actually, today is the first auction. I haven't read too much about what's been going on today, but it is the launch of this new market within California. As far as what's anticipated for next year, in the current legislative session, the one that ended in September, the legislature did enact a bill, AB 1532, which provides sort of a framework for how the state is going to spend that money going forward, but it's a very general framework. Essentially, the Department of Finance is going to release an expenditure plan next spring, and then the budget that will be finalized next June will have to be consistent with that expenditure plan. There's sort of a public input process into that expenditure plan, but there's no formal adoption of it by the legislature, so as advocates seeking transportation funding in that plan, we're going to be working, kind of lobbying the Air Resources Board and working with the administration to make sure that transportation is included. And it's a three-year expenditure plan, so it'll cover 13, 14, 15, 16, and 16, 17. So that's one piece of it. It's a budget strategy. The second is more of a long-term legislative strategy, and that is to secure all of the allowance revenue from the cap-and-trade program that's associated with transportation fuels for transportation. And the rationale there is that, you know, it's anticipated that this new program, having a cap on carbon for transportation fuels, is going to translate into some higher gas prices at the pump. And so it's not a tax, but it'll look and smell like a tax. And traditionally, all transportation fuel taxes have gone towards transportation. So that's our strategy there. We did adopt a formal set of principles in June, and I didn't bring those with me, but happy to provide them to you at a later date. And within those principles, that's one core piece of it, is that all of the transportation fuel allowances should go to transportation improvements, projects that reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the transportation sphere. And we're also part of a bigger coalition that's going to be making that case. So that's on cap and trade. You know, Egon, if people do want to ask questions as we go, that's fine. I'm just realizing it'll be a lot to digest, and people will probably forget their questions if we wait till the end.
Maybe if there's some really quick questions as we're going through on cap and trade. I know I have two little ones. One is, where do you see high-speed rail fitting in terms of MTC's advocacy? And the second one, you talk about projects, and are there some that are interested in trying to push this for transit operating funds versus capital funds? If you could just sort of say whether the principle is general and it could go to either one.
On the first question of high-speed rail, I don't think we've really figured that out yet. Certainly the administration has indicated they are interested in funding high-speed rail out of this pot of money. I would say we don't want high-speed rail to absorb all of the transportation funding that could, you know, be made available from this revenue stream. But we haven't worked out, you know, specific percentages as far as, you know, what we're comfortable with for high-speed rail versus other modes. On the question of capital versus operations, absolutely, you know, we see it as a general revenue source, and we would want to see transit operations made eligible, as well as other operational projects such as ramp metering and things like that that can speed up and reduce congestion so that you don't have as many emissions associated with freeways as well. Okay, next item on the state budget, just defending transportation funds from future cuts. This shouldn't be as much of a challenge as it has been in years past. We have made significant strides in the Constitution as far as securing transportation revenue, but there are some funds that still may be looked upon, so we'll be guarding those carefully. There's a new proposal that's making its rounds in the transportation world right now. It hasn't been introduced as a specific bill yet, but we do expect that to happen sometime probably in December. And the champion for this is the group Transportation California, which is basically a construction lobbying group. Their proposal is to seek an increase in the vehicle license fee. This is the fee that was cut significantly under Governor Schwarzenegger. It used to be 2%, and it went down all the way to 0.65%. So there's kind of a delta, if you will, a difference of 1.35%. That could generate around $4 billion a year, significant funding. The reason that they're interested in this is they've done a lot of polling. They've been, you know, looking at the gas tax and other types of ongoing dedicated sources of funding for transportation, and the VLF pulls a lot higher than the gas tax. It's, you know, a one-time, what per year expense. It is considered quite progressive because this is not a flat fee like a registration fee. This is essentially a property tax on cars. It's based on the value of the vehicle, and it, you know, adjusts downward over time as the car depreciates. And so the more expensive your car, of course, the more expensive or the higher charge you will be paying. So It's an interesting proposal. I think it will be probably somewhat controversial. It was considered general fund revenue prior to the cut made several years ago, and so taking those funds and dedicating them to transportation may be perceived as kind of an opportunity cost for the general fund or even for local government, which also has received some of this funding and through their own VLF charges. But, you know, we're going to basically, the LEDGE program is saying we're going to engage on this. And it, in terms of how the money would be spent, we'd like to see an even split between local streets and roads, capital expansion type projects, and public transit.
Rich and then Carlos.
I'm very supportive of this approach. People who've lived in other states realize that there is a personal property tax, much like your tax on your house, on your vehicles, your RVs, your boats. My first car was a 51 Ford in 1957, and my licensing fees with personal property tax were more than I pay now.
Carlos?
Is there discussion, since I don't know how it's polling specifically, but if the increase, the delta, I think what did you say was 1.3?
3.5.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If that delta, I didn't quite get it, was the delta what would be set aside for transportation? Because you're saying that it's being used for general fund, or is it the entire 2% that would be?
No, just the increase. So the baseline of 0.65, which is currently going to the general fund, would stay there, correct?
Tina?
I thought that a lot of that vehicle license fee went to the Air District. And is that not the case?
It's not uncommon to confuse, you know, the terminology, the vehicle license fee, registration fee. The Air District has a registration fee associated with it, with the Carl Moyer program. I believe it's $4 per vehicle. That's totally different from this. Yeah.
My quick question is, the bill that passed, the Leno bill that allows San Francisco to increase it to 2% independently, is there a strategy to try to make sure that doesn't become, you know, every county wants to do that themselves, and then we lose the ability to aggregate that money at a state level or at a regional level for statewide or regional priorities? If you could just say a word or two about how that fits in. I don't know if MTC endorsed that bill last year or not.
We didn't take a formal position on it because it was for general fund, which, granted, in San Francisco, a lot of that does go to transportation, but no, we didn't weigh in on that. I think we haven't really dug into that yet, but clearly there will need to be some thinking about, you know, how does it fit in with local measures, and most likely I would think people would want to see something similar with the sales tax, where you know, there's currently a statewide cap on how much local agencies can raise their own sales tax, but some counties have gotten exemptions from that cap so that they can choose to tax themselves at a higher rate. So I think we would be looking at something along those lines so that San Francisco wouldn't have to lose out on this new VLF, and yet they could continue to tax themselves more if they chose to do so for general fund. Okay, should we move on from that one? The next item that we do anticipate working on quite a bit is the MAP 21 implementation legislation. So now that we have the new federal bill, a lot of the state law that guides how funds are distributed within California is moot. It references outdated code sections and federal law. So part of this is technical cleanup, but part of it really does translate into a battle over dollars and where those dollars are going to go. One of, I think, our priority is to maximize the amount of flexible funding that comes from the state to the metropolitan areas so that you're really concentrating transportation revenue where the people are. So that's going to be our strategy there. And really this deals with STP funding and CMAQ primarily. On CEQA, item 5.
Actually, Rebecca, did you skip the B, the lower the two-thirds majority vote?
Oh, I'm sorry, I did.
Okay.
So going back to 3A and B, and I should note there was some discussion at the Legislation Committee about this, about kind of maybe staff needs to prioritize and pick one because these are both kind of ambitious goals. So 3B is a longstanding idea that actually might be achievable now that we have a two-thirds majority in both the Assembly and the Senate. of Democrats. That is, the idea would be to pass a constitutional amendment to lower the vote threshold from 2/3 to 55% for transportation taxes at the local level. So this is something that, you know, we've had an ERLEG program forever. It never gets out of the legislature, but this year it does seem like it would be a unique opportunity to move that. And with Alameda County still kind of counting ballots and not looking so good, I think its salience is more relevant than ever.
And just a quick comment on that. If that's going to be on the ballot, I don't know the soonest ballot that could be on. If it's November of 2013 or probably 2014, it would have to be. Then it seems like that would be appropriate time to prepare the next round of transportation measures to go for that. Because I believe if it was written appropriately, if they were both on the same ballot, you could pass a transportation measure with 55%.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, the 2/3 in my area, that would be helpful, because as you know, Solano and Napa counties are the only two counties that don't have a dedicated local transportation tax. And
well, Napa County does now.
They does now, right? But Solano County is that last one, and you know, they had, I think, 3 elections over the years to try and get to that 2/3, and you know, they just keep coming short. They just never quite get into that 2/3 mark. So I think this is one issue that, you know, they would and I would pay attention to on the local level.
Absolutely. Thank you. So as I mentioned, I think I went through item 4 on MAP 21. Item 5, the California Environmental Quality Act, CEQA. There's a lot of talk in Sacramento right now. There's a working group that's been going on. It's an invite-only working group. I'm not on the invite list. It's high-level attorneys who are well-versed in the intricacies of CEQA, meeting with the pro tem of the Senate and the Speaker's office. And I think the fact that it's getting, you know, such high visibility at the leadership level is a good indication that there really is interest in doing something on this. We've been working quite closely with Silicon Valley Leadership Group in this, getting ideas about, you know, specific changes that we want to try to see in CEQA, and the advocacy program lays those out. I don't need to go through all of them, but, you know, it's partly about streamlining the level of review that's required for certain projects if they are consistent with a sustainable community strategy, and then also curtailing the ability to litigate on certain kinds of issues, improving public disclosure, and changing or narrowing the types of projects that would even be subject to CEQA. For example, item 6 is our case that it doesn't really seem to make sense to us that if an operator wants to change their service levels, that warrants a CEQA review. You know, it might require some type of public input, but CEQA doesn't necessarily seem the appropriate process there. Any comments or discussions on that?
It's a big idea. This is really important, so it's good.
Okay. Okay. Project delivery is kind of a...
Thing quickly.
So is SVLG one of the stakeholders at that invite-only group?
I'll turn to Bennett
probably.
Yeah.
Yes. So Shiloh Ballard is the person in our office that is in charge of this particular issue, and she's on a bunch of different committees. But I know she's working closely with the new chair of the Senate's Environmental Quality Committee, who has jurisdiction over this particular issue. So if you're interested in getting involved, please let me know. I'd love to connect you.
Thanks. Item 6 is project delivery. This is kind of a placeholder. You know, we're not planning on sponsoring a bill here, but just to let you and the public and our commission know that we continue to keep our eye on any legislation that's going to help speed up the length of time it takes to deliver projects through creative contracting and things of that nature. Item 7, SB 375 implementation. This is sort of a two-prong approach. We recently learned about the fact that the Housing and Community Development Department, HCD, is actually going to have an additional $50 million in Prop 1C funding as a result of the fact that with the lack of redevelopment funding available as match to projects that had already been committed, a lot of these projects now have funding shortfalls, and so they're not able to spend money that was already programmed. So there's going to be a new cycle of grants to the tune of $50 million for infill incentive and TOD grants. So we're going to engage in that and hope that Bay Area can benefit from that program. On item 7B, this is basically our case that we want to find a new source of funding to...
Wait, I think we had a question about that.
Okay.
Sorry, Carlos.
Yeah, just on the HCD, is there any discussion or thoughts of maybe even trying to encourage HCD to... I think that was a bond issuance, though.
Right.
But continuing that same spirit of working closely with... the land use and transportation type, you know, beyond the remaining $50 million from MTC standpoint?
I'm not sure I quite understood the question.
It sounds like you're monitoring the $50 million that basically got returned because, mm-hmm. you know, there was lack of, or whatever reason, and that's kind of the end of that program. And so the question is, would MTC... want to be working with the state HCD to try and see if something like that could be continued in the future in terms of looking at infill infrastructure, transit-oriented development type monies at the state level, just kind of advocating mm-hmm. and, you know, trying to see if those things can continue.
Well, I think that's a good segue really to 7B, because what that is basically the case that we think that additional funding to help develop affordable housing and to, you know, really help develop the infrastructure that's going to support TOD really needs to happen at the local level. We don't expect Sacramento to pass a new tax for that purpose, but we want Sacramento to pass the tools to allow tax increment financing to resume, to allow other types of local revenue options at the local level to support that.
You guys can just jump in because I may not be seeing the light because
okay.
I'm reading.
Right.
Okay, well, you know, this is obviously a hot button issue in my area, as most people know, you know, in this economic downturn and with loss of redevelopment and foreclosures and everything, this has affected my area, Solano County, really hard. And so and the controversy surrounding affordable housing as well, too, and the RENA numbers, you know, members of the public in my area has become alerted and expressing their views on this issue, especially with the loss of redevelopment. So I think that with mention here about economic development, affordable housing, I think this is kind of like a yes-no thing. I think if you're going to support it based on where it's going to be skewed more towards economic development, I think you'll get more of a positive local feedback on that. However, if this thing is going to be skewed more towards affordable housing, I think there you're going to run into a buzzsaw on the local level. Because they're really, you know, the local sentiment now in my area is more towards, you know, we need to get the economic thing going as opposed to focusing more on housing, particularly affordable housing.
There's another thing that you really need this kind of TIF financing to bring the TIFIA funding to the fore, which is transportation-based funding. That funding needs local sharing, local money, and part of that money can come from that stream of mm-hmm. TIFIA funding. Mm-hmm. So if TIFIA funding was available in the redevelopment transportation areas, you can leverage that highly with some funds that have been set aside already under the transportation bill exceeding $1 billion to get funding in transit corridors, both for transit projects and for housing projects.
Absolutely.
Will MTC be doing anything? you notice that you're providing technical assistance and support to local jurisdictions and seeking the funds, but will there be anything to specifically leverage, is it TOA, or the Transit-Oriented Affordable Housing Fund here at the regional level to make those work together and leverage each other?
That's a good question. Yeah, we haven't really thought about how, you know, this particular strategy ties in with TOA, but I think that makes sense, and we'll look into that.
Okay. Beck, I'll just say quickly, if you could try to see if you could finish this up in 5 minutes.
Okay.
It's really useful, but then because I know you have the other thing on the election.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. So bridge toll revenue, this is something we've been talking about for a while. I don't anticipate we'll run a bill this year, but basically the issue is that we are losing revenue right now because many cars in California are driving on our bridges without license plates because there's no requirement that a new vehicle get a temporary plate at the point of sale. Many other states have this. It's not difficult to do technologically. We just haven't had support in Sacramento to mandate it. So we're continuing to track it. Unfortunately, we don't have the support of law enforcement or the New Car Dealers Association to do anything about it yet. Carpool lanes, we're going to continue to track and probably oppose efforts to grant new access, free access to vehicles that are not carpools on our carpool lanes. We want to protect them for carpools or for express lanes in the event that they are converted. Parking policy, that's still on our radar and something we're going to track and engage in. We're not planning to sponsor a bill on this, but you know, if something pops, we'll be bringing it to our Ledge Committee on that. A new item, school siting reform. This is something that was brought to our attention from Contra Costa County, and when I went to the Bay Area CMA Association meeting and brought this up, there was a lot of nodding of heads that this is a real problem. And the issue is that school districts are totally independent from cities, counties, state regulation. They operate unto themselves when it comes to where they want to site schools. And this can work at cross purposes with other goals, such as safe routes to schools and trying to encourage, you know, more biking and walking to school and the like. So there is a new bond that's planned, and apparently the California Department of Education has indicated its interest in trying to do a better job, kind of integrating into state plans, and so we're going to kind of track that, monitor that, keep them on that course so that it's more consistent with SB 375 and our own regional plans. At the federal level, you know, we don't anticipate that this is going to be a very big year. We just got the two-year bill with MAP 21. It's going to be a focus on appropriations for our New START full funding grant agreement candidates, Muni and VTA. We are tracking air traffic control funding. There's a big push to try to do more there to improve efficiency of our airports. We're going to be advocating on that front. And then the last item, item three, is I think there was a proposal. It hasn't gone very far, but it was introduced, the Marketplace Fairness Act, which basically is the idea of taxing e-commerce at the same rate as whatever the tax rate is where the original purchaser is making that transaction. And that would bring money back to not only the state, but also to the local jurisdictions. And since so much of our revenue is sales tax based, that could have some transportation revenue benefits. That's the program in a nutshell. This is your chance to give us input before we provide the final program to the Legislation Committee in December.
And I would just say maybe, yeah, two kind of things to think about. One is, is anything missing? And any of these things that we would want staff to emphasize in their lobbying? So, Benna, Rich, and we'll try to be fast.
For the Resolution 3434 advocacy under the federal program, does that also include the second phase of the BART extension to San Jose, Silicon Valley? That's a big priority.
You know, that is part of our Resolution 3434 definition of the project, but since the FFGA is for this portion of it, the advocacy is going to be focused on that portion.
Okay. No, I understand that we've got the full funding grant agreement.
Right.
But I know we are gearing up for the second round. We're going to go back for another slice of the federal pie at some point in time.
Right.
So I want to make sure that was on your radar screen.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you if this is true, because I don't know, and then if it can be used. I've been told, and actually I read an editorial, I think it was in the Chronicle with JetBlue, that airport funding is so much in the trust fund for many of the airports in California, that some of that money, since the high-speed rail is going to augment air travel, should be used to invest in high-speed rail. Is there any possibility of that, or is it even correct?
So the idea was that there's a balance in the airport trust fund at the federal level that's not being used?
So much of the money has just been, well, it hasn't been used. If it's been used, it's like Social Security. It's been used on other things, and there are IOUs sitting there.
It has been used on airports.
You know, I'm not very well versed in this, but what I do know is that the needs on especially the air traffic modernization front and whatnot far exceed the latest authorization that was passed on FAA. So I'd be surprised if there's a whole lot of money just sitting around, you know, unappropriated.
This money's for like runways and things like that based on landing fees.
Okay.
That's what the editorial said.
Okay. Well, I'll look into it.
I just have a really couple quick comments. One is I think that it would be nice to have high-speed rail expressly noted somewhere in here, particularly because the Bay Area has kind of been pushed aside for a couple years, and we're in a regroup on high-speed rail. And so our ability to get funding and build it here is probably going to be based on both our ability to come up with funding on our own as well as advocacy in Sacramento. Second comment I wanted to make quickly was on the increased transportation funding. I know there was a letter here and some comments about pushing for transit operations. And one thing, just because we spent most of today talking about the Transit Sustainability Project, I think the piece that would be nice to push at the state level there is, yes, more money for transit operations, but some performance criteria associated with that funding. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that there's an ability, if there's an augmentation overall funding for transit, there's some performance metrics that are included mm-hmm. in that.
Okay.
Well, I think you've kind of summarized. I was going to bring up the, because I thought that on the cap and trade, it was not so much focused to transit, but more transportation and maybe even looking at alternative fuels. So I would like to try and focus some of that on to the increasing and bringing back some of the transit service. And I like what Aegon said, too, of, you know, seeing if there's any kind of performance measures. I don't know how that works at the state level, but definitely something along those lines, too.
Can you give an example of some of the parking policy reforms that you're talking about in 10A?
Sure. One example would be AB 904. That was a Skinner bill that was it was actually a gut and amend this past session, so it was amended late in the session around June, July. But it was similar to a bill the same author, Assemblymember Skinner, had introduced the year before, AB 710. And basically what it did was it put a cap on the amount of off-street parking that a city can require of a housing or commercial development that was within a half a mile of a transit-intensive area. So just to restate it, because it can be very confusing, it's not requiring a maximum, but it's saying a city can't require more than. If a developer wanted to provide more, they'd be free to, but a city couldn't require more than, for example, one space per unit for housing within a half a mile of high-quality transit. We actually had a big workshop on this subject last Friday here at MTC. There's going to be a lot of information on our website about that, the video. You know, it was opposed by the League of Cities. We actually didn't formally support it, but that's an example, you know, of a bill on that subject. And the reason I think clearly it has a transportation nexus is to the extent that there's a lot of excess parking above and beyond what might be needed, you're going to have lower transit ridership. You're going to have less biking and walking in areas that otherwise, you know, would be pretty transit, walking, biking friendly. And so we just want to be encouraging more sustainable parking policies.
Great. I just wanted to make sure it wasn't like, oh, increase your parking ticket prices, fees. But my other comment was about high-speed rail and there's nothing mentioned in here. Does MTC take a position on high-speed rail? And
well, I was going to follow up on Aegon's comment about that, too. You know, certainly as we're drafting this, I'm thinking about high-speed rail, but there really isn't a specific action that we anticipate from the legislature this next year. You know, there was a large appropriation last year. They appropriated not only, you know, funding to get the initial construction going in the Central Valley, but also over $1 billion for electrification of Caltrain and a lot of the other improvements that are relevant to Northern California. So I think a lot of our high-speed rail work was done last year. Not to say there isn't going to be more, but I don't think there will be anything in 2013 on this subject. There won't be a budget appropriation on this, and there isn't any other real legislative action anticipated next year. So, you know, if something comes up, we'll be on it. But really, this is trying to anticipate what issues will we need to deal with next year. And I don't think high-speed rail is one of them for now.
Okay. Are there other comments on this, or are there any interest? Yeah, Sandy, just say if there's any interest in trying to formulate. We've given you a lot of specific comments, but yes.
I just also wanted to support the idea of proactively looking for opportunities to increase transit operation funding.
Okay. Thanks. Can I make one last comment about cap and trade and transit operations just to give you kind of a feel of, I think, the direction that MTC and some of the other large MPOs are going? You know, we see this funding as definitely a great opportunity to provide revenue stream to support the sustainable community strategies. And so building on that framework, what we would like to see, and this is articulated in our adopted principles, is a large portion of the funding, maybe even all of it, coming to regions on the basis of some formula. Maybe it's population, maybe it's share of transportation-related greenhouse gas emissions. Those are going to be highly correlated. But coming to the MPOs to basically implement the sustainable community strategies. So we wouldn't want the legislation itself to dictate this amount for transit operations, X amount for, you know, streets and roads. That would be a decision that would be made at the regional level. And it, you know, wouldn't also be something that you'd make at one time and you'd be locked into that. You'd be making it, you know, on a semi-regular basis to respond to the particular needs at the time. So, you know, I just want to kind of point out, I don't think we're going to be advocating for any specific amount for transit operations, but it's absolutely something that we want to ensure is eligible from that pot of money. And what we're trying to do is to get that control over how we spend the money down to the regional level, not in Sacramento.
But the overall ask in terms of pushing for that flexibility for operations, especially given the previous conversation and looking at how variable that is, that's not contingent upon the delegation down to regional level, is it?
Yeah, okay. So absolutely. The eligibility needs to be specified in Sacramento in the bill.
Mm-hmm. And then we're going to probably need to hear your last piece.
So help me out. I may be wrong, but it seems like the ballot measure to raise the vehicle license fee is duplicative of the registration fee. So when you buy a vehicle, let's say you buy a $20,000 vehicle, you have to pay $400. First of all, can that be? Does anyone know if that can be enrolled into somebody's, say, auto loan? I mean, who can pay that?
Talking about the sales tax?
No, the vehicle license fee. So when you buy a new vehicle, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have to pay a 2% vehicle license fee that goes toward what you're supporting here.
Well, right now it's not 2%. So the current vehicle license fee is 0.65%. But
you're advocating to raise it up to 2%,
right,
which would be a $400 fee on a $20,000 vehicle. Mm-hmm. But then people also have to pay $4 a car every time they register their registration for their vehicle every year. So they're paying both, and they both, so the $4 on registration fee goes to the transportation funds for clean air managed by the Air District, and this would go toward also transportation projects.
Right. Yeah, they are multiple fund sources or multiple components of taxes or fees on vehicles that would be going to transportation. I think, you know, the idea is that There's room to raise the registration vehicle license fee on vehicles because it was something that people were accustomed to paying at a much higher rate up until a few years ago. So now California has one of the lowest vehicle license fees, you know, in the country. And as I mentioned, in thinking about, well, what are some of our options to raise new sources of revenue for transportation, obviously a gas tax would be one option. That is extremely unpopular. And this is something that, based on polling, was much more popular. But I do want to clarify, it's not a one-time payment. This would be an annual payment. So you would pay it upon your initial registration, and then every time you pay your registration, you would pay it again. But it would depreciate depending on the level, with the depreciation of your vehicle. So it would be rolled into your overall registration charges.
So when I get my vehicle registration, it's 2%, so I would have to pay, if my car's worth $20,000, I'd have to pay $400?
Correct.
Yeah, Tina, maybe I'm sorry to cut it off, because we're past time. Maybe you guys can sort of talk afterwards, and just to clarify it. Sorry, okay. Are people able to stay a few more minutes, though?
The other thing is, I don't really need to walk through the election update. I think everyone, you know, can just read that at their leisure. So, yeah, it's fine. I don't think it's any news that anybody doesn't already know. So,
okay. Well, are there other final comments to Rebecca on this before we close? And I should just say, I think you guys are next meeting in December. We have an advisory council meeting before that, but in terms of formulating any kind of real proposals, if there's, we've given you some comments today, but we don't have a motion thus far. Frank and then Rich.
I'll just say one thing regarding the proposed vehicle license fee. I would suggest veterans should be exempt from the new fee. Probably that will bring some goodwill and get it to pass. California veterans should be exempt from the new fee for the service.
We had a measure on the ballot about 4 years ago to place a tax on oil companies for an extraction fee. It failed after millions and millions of dollars were dumped in here by the Koch brothers and others by a very small fraction. I know that there are groups now looking at the possibility with a two-thirds majority of placing a wellhead tax, and that is a tax on the depletion of riches under California soil that they get no tax on, but we are the only state in the nation that has oil and gas reserves that's not levy such tax, and it's high time we do it.
Are you asking MTC to put that into the ledge agenda?
I'd love it.
I was going to mention that, by the way, and I just let it lie. It's amazing that he picked my mind the way he did. That is amazing. Louisiana and Texas, they make all their money that way, and Alaska hands out checks to the people based on that.
Well, let's let that stand as a suggestion to staff. Why don't we, since we're past time, thank Rebecca for sharing all of this. This was very useful, and I guess if there's more individual questions or comments, we can kind of follow up with her directly.
Absolutely.
Sorry, Tina,
Thank you. Cutting
off. Just you could. Lastly, turn to Pam for the staff liaison report.
Oh, I guess I have to turn this on. Well, I just wanted to point out in the report the two main things, that there is an update for you on MTC's move to 390 Main Street. We're trying to make sure that you are kept apprised in that process. And from time to time, there are reports that come out that I will include. I'm not well-versed on it, so I can't answer your questions. But if at any time you want staff who is well-versed on it to come before you and give you a briefing, we can arrange for that as well. And then the other item to point out of note is proposed updates to the JARC and New Freedom program. And these are predicated on Title VI circular, the new Title VI circular. And I think most of them relate to subrecipients and limited English proficient requirements. So I know that Kristen Mazur is the key staff person. Again, on that, I'm not as well versed in it, but she is here today. And if you want to corner her afterwards, raise your hand, Kristen. If you want to corner her afterwards, if you have specific questions, or again, we can arrange for some sort of comment to come before the subcommittee. I'm not sure quite how timely that might be, considering the changes that need to go forward, but we can always do that as well. So please catch myself or Kristen after if you have questions on that. I think that's probably the best way to go because of the late time. And then I also just want to point out for the record that you should have gotten copies of letters that were sent to you. We always try to make sure that you get them from the public. The one that Egon mentioned earlier from Public Advocates and Urban Habitat. And then there was a second item from a gentleman from Pacifica. So if you didn't get those, there are handouts over on the table.
Thank you very much, Pam. Now we turn quickly to council member reports. Any reports anyone want to make? Okay, seeing none. Item 10, new business. Any suggestions on new business? We have a lot of business to work on ourselves. Okay, well, with that, we'll adjourn the meeting, and we'll meet here again December 12th, 2012. Thank you all very much.